and welcome to the Praise Aero podcast. The following is a conversation I had with Brendan Kumarasamy. Brendan is the founder of Master Talk, a YouTube channel which he started to help people master the art of public speaking and communication. He now helps purpose-driven entrepreneurs achieve their milestones in life and master their message. I learned a lot from this conversation, and I hope you do too. Happy listening. Hi, Brendan. Thank you for making it today. It's great to have you.
Praise, the pleasure is absolutely mine. Thanks for having me.
I'll start off by just letting the audience know a little bit more about you. Maybe you could describe yourself in a few words. Who would you say Brendan is?
Yeah, for sure, Praise. Thanks for having me on. So yeah, my name is Brendan. I'm the founder of Master Talk. Master Talk is a YouTube channel and a coaching practice I started to help the world master the art of communication and public speaking. And how I got started, Praise, was when I was in college. I went to business school. And my goal is never to be an entrepreneur or a YouTuber. I wanted to be an accountant, funny enough. So that's what I studied in. But then as I was doing these competitions called case competitions, think of it like professional sports, but for nerds. So while the guys my age are playing footy or rugby, I wasn't one of those guys. I did presentations competitively, and that's how I learned how to speak. But then as I got older, I started coaching a lot of the students on how to communicate, just because I wanted them to win competitions. And I accidentally got really good at communication coaching. That's what led to Master Talk later in my life.
Oh, wow. You accidentally got good at communications coaching. So how long have you been doing this?
I've been coaching since I was 19. So I'm going on year 8 now. And I started the YouTube channel in 2019.
So a little bit more about your public speaking journey. You said you were competing. So basically the competitions and the coaching just sort of put you out there. Well, can you talk a little bit more about the competition experience?
For sure. Absolutely, Bryce. So it's a very small community. So not many people know what a case competition. So I'm happy to elaborate. So this is not like a debate or moot court in law school. This is very specific just to business school students. So let's start with the first question, which is why do they exist? The reason they exist is to give companies an opportunity to sponsor them so they could hire the best talent. So I'll give you an example. Let's say Amazon is a case sponsor. They'll spend, let's say, tens of thousands of dollars to sponsor the competition. And then what they'll do is they'll bring their executives to the competition and give students a problem that Amazon has within the business. So they might say something like, okay, Praise, okay, Brendan, I need you to help me figure out where should I open my next Amazon Go store or my next Amazon warehouse. Should I open it in Cologne, Germany, or should I open it in New York City? And then you as two students or as groups of students need to figure out, hey, what's the best solution? And then you pitch it back to the executives of Amazon, and whoever they like, they just give them job offers to work for them. So the goal is for them to pick up the top talent before any other company does. And I was obsessed with these competitions.
Right. And so how did that play any role in your career, the competitions themselves?
You got it. So early in my career, I just wanted a job. That's when I was 19 years old, I went to a lot of these cocktails and I didn't come from a lot of money. So I didn't have a network. So I had a big fat suit on that I bought for $100 at prom that I still reused. Mm-hmm. I didn't have any network in the school. So I would just go up to interns and say, like, how did you get this job at Deloitte or PwC and all these companies I wanted to work for? And they all just looked at me and they said, case competitions. I'm like, hey, what's a case competition? They said, yeah, if you compete in these, you'll get the opportunities most people don't. So that's how I actually got into them, Praise. I did them out of necessity. But then after, I fell in love with them. I just had an unhealthy obsession with them. I got the job that I wanted, but I just really enjoyed them. So that's one piece of it. And the other piece is how I accidentally stumbled into Master Talk. You know, by the time I was 22, I'd probably coached 60 or 70 people, mostly for free on how to speak. And then somebody just asked me a question, where did you learn how to speak? And I just went, I don't know, I'm just self-taught. And then they asked me about YouTube, like, did you watch YouTube videos? And that's what sparked the idea for Master Talk. I started watching all the videos online and they weren't really good. So that's what led to me starting it.
Right. So your coaching experience, what was that like? Did you just, like, how did you exactly become a coach from competing, then becoming a coach? How did that happen?
Yeah, for sure, Praise. Great question. So what happened was, that was also accidental. So how this program works is that it's student run. So 400 people, 300 people apply every year to join JMCC. That's what it's called, the John Molson Competition Committee. And we pick probably 60 or 70 of them to join. So probably 20 to 30% of them get accepted into the program. That's how it works. And then from that 20, 30%, then we go off to compete in Australia and Serbia and Singapore, and they all go out to different competitions around the world, which I know is freaky. Like, literally, there's people who fly out from Australia to Montreal, where I live in Canada. Their business school spends all the money. They pay for all the flights. And all they have to do during the week is party and give PowerPoint presentations. It's really fascinating. It's a very fascinating world of competitions. So what happened was when I was 20, I started winning a lot of these competitions. I was losing a bunch, too, but I was doing well. And then I became one of the student executives who was running the program. And I just looked at all the delegates we selected this year, and I was like, 20 of them don't even know how to communicate. They're really smart, but they don't know how to speak. And we didn't have a communication coach, and I was just a really good communicator, so I just said, oh, let's figure it out. So to answer your question, I had no idea how to coach people, like zero. I knew how to speak, but it's a completely different skill set to coach somebody else. It is. So I just made a ton of mistakes. And obviously, like I mentioned, everyone's really smart. So whenever I made a mistake in coaching, they would just correct me. They go, oh, that doesn't really make sense. And that's why a lot of my ideas, I think, are really fresh, because I never really learned them from anyone else. I kind of just made mistakes and stumbled along the way.
Oh, that's cool. And after that, when did you decide you want to... You said by the time you started Master Talk, you had coached 60, 70 people.
Correct.
And all that. So this 60, 70 was also just... during your time as an executive?
You got it. Literally 100% of the time. And let me make sure we're clear on terms. Executive is not like I was some vice president. I'm a kid, right?
Yeah, I got it.
Yeah, so I'm a kid. So let's say I was there for like 3 years. I might be, maybe I coach. I don't know the exact number, but I probably coach like 15, 20 people a year. But all of that was for free. I didn't even know you get paid or this could be a profession. Like, I had a job at IBM as a consultant lined up post-graduation. So I was looking forward to, and I worked there for 3 years before two and a half before I left for Master Talk. So yeah, that's what happened.
All right. Okay. So we'll come back to Master Talk, and then let's talk about public speaking itself. Why do you think it's important outside the cases, right? You had the reason you were coaching people for case competitions, but outside of that, why do you think it's important for people to learn how to speak in their everyday life? You know, the regular person who's not necessarily going for a case competition.
Exactly, Pri. So you're right. When I started Master Talk, I never saw communication as a skill set that everyone should learn. I just saw it as something that you get better at case competitions with. But of course, my thesis has evolved a lot since then. I've gotten better, thankfully, since that day. So here's what I'll say. Communication is about leading a more fulfilling life because it impacts every area of life. It's not just the way that we communicate in competitions, obviously. It's the way that we talk to our family. It's the ways that we raise our children. It's the way that we order food at a restaurant. It's the way that we make new friends. It's every area of our life. That's why I call it the accelerant of dreams. It doesn't really matter what you dream of or what you want in life. Communication helps you accelerate that dream a lot faster. That's why I'm a big fan of it and why I'm such a big advocate for it. So for everyone listening to this question, this conversation, all you do is ask yourself three questions. The first one is, what do you want in life? It could be anything. You want to be a mother, you want to be a father, you want to be an executive at a company or a CEO of a business. What do you want? The second question is, who already has what you want? Who already has what you desire? And then the third question that none of us think about, Praise, is the person who has what we want, what kind of communicator are they? And that is the question we don't think to ask.
Wow. So when you discover what kind of communicator they are, you try to copy that template. Is that what happens after you ask yourself the third question?
Right. So there's two things that happen. Great follow-up. So the first one is it addresses the gap. So you go, okay, you know, if I want to be, let's say, the CEO of a $7 million business, if I'm not communicating like one, how am I supposed to get there? So that's one piece. So the other piece is, so the first one is what you talked about, the template. But the second piece is going, okay, now I need to work on this. So I'm more motivated to take it seriously. I've always believed that the number one challenge of communication, Praise, actually is not the fear. I think fear is number two. The reason is because there are so many things in our life that we are scared of. Starting a podcast, starting a YouTube channel, having kids, you know, going to college, getting a job interview. All these things scare us, but our motivation is greater than our fear, so we do it. Whereas in communication, I find that our motivation isn't great enough to do it, so we just never overcome the fear because of it. So that's the way I've always thought about it.
I see. So for your case, who would you say are the top people that, you know, you looked at that triggered you to improve your own communication skill set?
For sure. Definitely subjective, but I'll give you my thoughts. I would say for me, probably Scott Harrison, the CEO and founder of Charity Water. I love the way that he communicates ideas. He raises like money to help people gain access to clean water across the world. I think the guy's absolutely brilliant. He's probably one of the best storytellers on the planet. So I follow Scott Harrison's work a lot. Lewis Howes, I think, is really good. He's the host of the School of Greatness podcast, and he's an exceptional speaker. I really love the way that he communicates with humility, something I definitely didn't have earlier in my life, and I'm still trying to work on. And the third piece is Gary Vaynerchuk. Of course, everyone either loves Gary Vee or they don't. I'm personally a fan of what he's done and the brand he's built, so I look at his tone a lot. And what I like is he's really to the point, so I try and bring that in the way I convey ideas too. But that's just like three of like, I've probably studied hundreds of these people, but those are the top three.
Got it. And you've been coaching for a few years now. What's that experience been like for you? Maybe lessons you've learned as a coach. That's one. And then the next is, what has been the toughest case you faced when trying to coach someone?
Absolutely, Pris. So here's what I'll say. Let me start with this, which is you find out pretty quickly if you should be a coach or not when you start coaching people, because it's a very high energy sport. You have to really love people. You have to really like interacting with them. Like you have to genuinely like having this podcast interview, or else you can't be a coach. Like it doesn't make sense, because you'll just burn out from all the energy that people are throwing at you. Because even if you're a communication coach, people don't just bring communication problems to you, right?
Right.
Because you're building a bond with them, a relationship, almost like a marriage. So yeah, it starts with communication, but then you're having dinner with them. They're going like, how do I talk to my wife better? And I'm just there like, I'm not married. So how do I answer this question? So you kind of figure this out over time. That's what I would say, number one. Number two is, besides it being high energy, what I think I've learned that's fascinating, because the people I've coached has changed dramatically from when I started my career to what it is now. And what I found from YouTube is that there's a very big difference between someone who watches my free content, which is obviously my goal, right? I want to help every human being on earth become a great speaker. That's why I make those videos for free. That's why I started Mass Talk. It just accidentally turned into a business. But the other piece is the person who gets coaching from me is completely different than the person who watches my content. So what does that mean? So when I started coaching, it was mostly students in college that didn't have any money, but I just had fun with it, right? So I was just helping them coaching. But then as I evolved as a business owner, what ended up happening is executive CEOs and entrepreneurs ended up being my clients, where they would just watch one or two of my videos and they would go like, okay, this is good enough. Let me just hire the kid directly. I don't really have time to watch these videos. So it's just a different mindset. So, and then the third lesson I've learned is I've had to really ramp up my coaching, because at the beginning I was just coaching students primarily, but today my average client is like 20 years older than I am. So I have to be really well studied on what happens at the C-suite and VP boards so that I can educate my client in a way that I know more than they do, which is actually really challenging because I'm obviously 20 years their junior.
Yeah. I was going to ask, actually, what role reading plays in what you do.
And did you say reading?
Reading, yeah. And you've kind of just answered that question.
Well, I'm not that much of a reader, funny enough, Praise. I've only read like one or two books this year. I think it's more about doubling down on the method of learning that you get the best results from. So, for example, for me, it's not really reading. It's podcasting. So in addition to, you know, having conversations with you, I'm also listening to 10 hours of podcasts a week, 5 to 10, depending on what the week is and how crazy it is. But I'm listening to a lot of these conversations. That's how I get a lot better. That's one piece. And then the other piece is really, you know, as we say in French, essai erreur, right? Trial and error. You're just making a ton of mistakes as you're coaching people, and you learn through that experience on how to do better.
Yeah. Okay. All right, so how exactly does podcasting, listen to podcasts help? I kind of get why listening to podcasts would help, but, you know, at first I thought reading would be the first thing that would help, but then, okay, yeah, I'm kind of reframing my thinking right now on the spot. So the reason why I thought reading would be the first thing would be because, you know, when you, okay, you know what? I realize it's probably because I read more. I don't have any concrete reasons for that. I do listen to podcasts a lot as well. Well, I guess my primary go-to for learning, okay, probably not. No, I just realized my primary go-to for learning how to speak is also listening to podcasts. I thought it was reading, but apparently it's not. Reading just kind of helps me, you know, build my, what I say, vocabulary and, you know, ways of expression. But I guess if you're watching people who also are very good with speaking, that helps as well. Yeah, you can make up for that.
Right. So there's two parts I'd love to add on. So one is knowledge acquisition, and two is speaking. So speaking, of course, you know, you might listen to podcasts and watch TED Talks, right, Praise? But I'm actually commenting on the knowledge acquisition side. And the reason is because, here's my thesis, and it's not necessarily the right one, by the way. Like, you love reading more, so you should read. Here's what I think is fascinating about podcasting. A podcast is a one-hour investment of my life. Reading a book lets you do audiobooks, so I'm not a fast reader, and I don't retain the information as well. I'm not as smart as most people in the world. So it takes like 8-9 hours, right, to read a book. But what I love about podcasting, Praise, is it allows me to step into somebody's life for 1 hour and see if I'm getting value. Because if I'm not, I'm definitely not going to read their book. So that's what's fun about podcasting, is that same 8 to 10 hours, somebody's going to spend reading one book. I'm going to visit 8 to 10 different lives. That's how I've always seen it. And then the best people, like Scott Harrison, I've read his book cover to cover, like 3 copies of his book, like on my couch here. But the people that I really, really love, I'm like, wow, this person's really sharp. Then I can explore further. And I think that's what's nice about this format, is that it's really casual. And the information is layered in emotion. Whereas with the book, it's more like, okay, let's go through all the points. And it's still a cool story. But here it's like we're cracking jokes, we're having fun. So it's like you're learning a bunch of things, but you're still enjoying yourself.
Mm, got it. So a podcast sort of maintains all the emotions of the conversation and all of that, but a reading is sort of a removed, you know, takes a sort of disinterested view on the topic.
Right.
Well, a less emotional one. Right. So a little bit about competing. Do you still compete?
No. So how case competitions work is you retire at the end of your university career. And that's actually why I started Master Talk, Praise. It wasn't really to save the world at the beginning. Now it's a lot more focused on impact. But at the beginning, I was just bored because I started working at IBM and I realized the jig was up. I'm kind of like a boring version of how a professional athlete retires from their sport. So let's say you take an NBA player. 1 year, they're in the league. Everybody cares about them. They're the hottest thing in town. And then the next year, they retire. Nobody really cares about that. Maybe give them 2-3 more years. So there's like a shock because you don't know how to recreate that moment. I had that on a much, 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 much smaller scale, obviously. So it wasn't like 10,000 people. It was like 10 nerds kind of screaming my name here. But the point that I want to drive is when case competitions is over, I lost that jus de vie, right? It's like, what is that fire? Because I just started working and then I was like a lot more productive than most employees in the org because I just done these case competitions. So I kind of lost interest. I was like, okay, so what's the point of life now? Do I just make money? And that's what led me into Master Talk and gave me an idea to keep expanding and keep my life exciting.
Okay. And so the people you coach now, apart from your average client, you mentioned your the clients that you have. Do you still have the case competition participants as clients, or, you know, no?
Not really. So they never really were clients at the beginning, I would say, Praise. They were mostly just like students I was helping, and I wasn't charging them, right? So now what the model has evolved to, I speak at their committee once a year, kind of as a guest speaker now. I don't really spend as much time coaching them because I have too many clients at this point. so it's too much work for me. That's one. And then the second one is exactly why I started MassTalk, right? That's the initial spark was, oh, wow, like for the next 50 years, there's going to be 50 other case competition programs with 70 people. So there's like 3,500 people. I can't coach all 3,500. So why don't I just create a YouTube channel where I share all of these tips and people can watch? So that was the initial spark. I just didn't know how big it would turn into. I was like, oh, wait, it's not just for case competition people. It's for the mom in Minnesota who wants to be better for their kids, right? It's everybody. And that's when I was like, oh, okay, there's a much bigger play here I didn't see.
Yeah. Right. So what does your current practice routine look like? You know, from, I guess you have to keep up, you know. What does
for
it look
speaking?
Like now? Yeah.
For sure. So it's three things. We call them conversations, content creation, and coaching. So the first one is conversations, the one we're having right now. So the reason I do a lot of these interviews is to keep myself sharp, right? So that's why I say yes a lot. So that way I can just stay sharp from the different questions that people ask me and say, oh, I didn't really think about that. Praise is bringing up a good point. I need to make a video on that. So that's the first piece. The second piece is content creation. So I'm always staying ahead, creating a ton of content. So like for LinkedIn, I'm already done for 2023, like just writing that in advance. So I have a system going. And then the third piece is, of course, coaching. I stay really sharp, especially when I coach the best people in my ecosystem, because they already know everything from my YouTube channel. So if they want to keep coaching with me, I need to keep getting better, or else they'll be like, I got nothing to learn from you. So they actually push me to be a lot better and to create new thought leadership. I would say in addition to that, the rest of my practice routine, which is a bit more funny, on the funnier side, is I rap a lot. I probably do like an hour a week. Yeah. I'm not very good at it. I'm not going to be a professional by any means, but it helps a lot with pacing and articulation. And the other fun fact about me is I can karaoke in 8 different languages.
Oh, okay. What languages?
Yeah. So I speak 3 fluently, English, French, and Tamil. And then outside of those 3, I karaoke in 5. And by the way, my definition of karaoke, a couple of lining thoughts here. One, I don't sing well. Okay, that's the first one. That's like the obvious. The second one is when I'm singing in those languages, I don't understand them. And the third one is I qualify a language as long as I know at least one song. So Mandarin, I only know one song. Well, like
which
the other
one?
Ones. It's, don't ask me that question, that's funny. It's sung by Tang, Giwani no Ai or something like that. Yeah, I'm still not perfect in Mandarin, but
okay.
Yeah, it's like a really old song. So that's one. The other 4 languages are Hindi, Spanish, Korean, and Japanese.
All right. That's so nice.
Yeah, it helps with pronunciation. If you can practice, like let's say, for example, I did Japanese, right? Ohayo gozaimasu, genki desu ka? Or Italian, buongiorno, come stai, molto bene. Like when you switch languages that you don't really understand, it really helps your pronunciation in English.
Oh, I actually do sing in other languages, but I never thought it would feed back into my English pronunciation. And maybe it does, but I just haven't noticed that. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, you were going to say something?
No, I was about to say, me neither. I think the reason why I felt that later in my career is because it expands your vocal range. So for example, let's say you're having trouble pronouncing a word in English, but you start pronouncing words that literally you have no idea. Like you can't make any sense out of. Like Korean, I have no idea what's happening. Like I'm just looking at, it's called Hangul when you watch like the romanticization version of it and you kind of pronounce the word. I have no idea what they're saying. But if I can do that, your confidence level just skyrockets. Like, come on, like English, like I understand all the words. So I think your energy around those words change and you just put more effort to pronouncing them more effectively.
Now that you mention it, that's probably true. And I think the more languages that you learn and are able to pronounce, the easier it is for you to just, you know, pronounce any other thing in the world, whether it's in your language or any other language. Yeah. Because I started learning Chinese, and after when I started learning, it's like other languages just became sort of a lot easier, you know. And the first thing that happens is in your head, you realize, since I can do this, just like you said, if you can pronounce this language, then your confidence level sort of skyrockets and you feel, yeah, if I can pronounce this and I can pronounce practically anything. Because when you learn a new language, I think one of the most difficult challenges for the speaking aspect is believing that you can actually get the words out. Because the moment you see you don't believe you can get the words out, you're too scared to speak, and then everything comes out so, you know, tipsy-topsy.
Exactly. So what's the other languages that you sing in and speak in?
Okay, so I speak English, Russian, and Chinese. Well, Chinese
what?
Is still like...
Whoa, that's so cool. Why do you speak Russian? That's so interesting.
Because I studied there. I studied in Russia. That's where I did my bachelor's. So that's why I speak Russian.
Then, oh, like in Russia?
Yeah.
Wow. Why?
Interesting question. It was a scholarship. So it's a scholarship agreement between Nigeria and Russia. And so I studied there.
Wait, but how did you get the scholarship? Like, the Nigerians walk?
No, you write an exam, and if you pass, you get the scholarship. And
oh.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
And, yeah. So as for singing, I sing a lot in Chinese, but that's now it's fine. Now it's sort of relatively easy. Other languages would be French. I used to sort of understand French, but it's you know, I haven't spoken it in a long time, but I can still sing just fine in French. Then there's Spanish, Italian. What other language? I think that's about it. Those are the languages. Okay, there's Korean, but not much. I don't sing much in Korean. I don't know a lot of Korean songs, but yeah.
It's weird how we have the same similar interest. You're like the first person I've ever met that can do this.
No, it's nice. I mean, you don't. Like you said, you don't have to understand every single word. But the more you do it, actually, you sort of get a feel of the language. And sometimes you understand words and you don't even know why you understand what it means. But you sort of, but maybe you've seen something similar somewhere. You've picked it up and you begin to, even though you don't get the whole song, you get the context of the song, basically, just because you've sung a lot of songs in that language. It's a nice feeling, I think.
So what was, I mean, since you're letting me ask questions, what was it like studying in Russia?
It was fine. I mean, the most challenging part was the language, because the language of study was Russian, and that was a bit challenging. But I think you have some time, like a year, to learn the language, and after that you start studying. Like once you, if you have the right community around you, and I was also going to ask you about that, your community of friends and fellow public speakers. So for the language and for studying a foreign language, if you have the right community around you who believes that it's really possible, then it's fine, right? Because that was one thing I was really, really blessed to have. Friends who had done really well academically while studying a foreign language. And so I believe, okay, you know, if these guys can do it, then I can do it too. And so that took my confidence level up. Okay, I will admit that maybe somehow I kind of have an affinity for languages, so maybe it was kind of easier for me than some people. But in general, I would say the thing that helped me the most was having people who had done well to look up to. That really helped. And as for the community, like the indigenous community, I would say they were quite open. I mean, you meet good people and bad people everywhere, but people were, for the most part, nice. I'll put it that way.
Fascinating.
Okay, so back to Master Talk, and I said I was going to talk about the community. Ask about the community of friends you have. Do you have a community of people who do the same thing you do, and how does that feed back into your work?
For sure, Prey. So definitely, I was super lucky, and when I mean lucky, I really mean that specific word, where I just happened to go to a random university in Montreal that had the world's largest case competition program. Right, so 70 students is actually the biggest one on earth, which is pretty wild. So I was a pretty good speaker, but the reason I was pretty good is because everyone around me was shockingly really good. Like, they were strong. Because if you're not a great speaker, you can't get into this program, because you can't win competitions if you're speaking, or if you're not willing to get better at it. So that's what happened in the early days. But then when I took over the program as one of the VPs, one of the executives, quote unquote, I needed to show an example for my students, because I was managing 30 out of the 70. So I needed to be the best speaker in the room. So what would happen is, because of that peer group, we would always keep one-upping each other.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually pushed me definitely to be the person that I am today. That's actually what gave me an unfair advantage, I think, when I started Master Talk, because I developed probably 2 decades worth of experience in 3 year, because I'd presented probably 300-400 times in those 3 years, which it was a wild, wild 3 years. Like, wow. It was crazy. Think of it like you're on a sports team. Like, I missed Christmas 3 times with my family. I would just be at school practicing and coaching the students, because that's what I wanted to do. Because the competition was January 4th. So it's like, we're not taking Christmas break. Mm. We gotta practice it and win these things. So yeah, it was a wild, wild time for sure. And then what happened is my peer group started to change. So I will admit that my peer group isn't as strong as it was in my early days. I think it's really hard to replicate those case competition environments. But today, those peer groups for me are my business partners. That's one piece. The second piece are my advanced clients. So I always have to be better than them, or else they'll never pay for my coaching. That's the second piece. And then the third piece are just some great communicators that I meet along the way, professional speakers doing really, really well in the space that are mentors of mine that I look up to. So it's a mix of those three things.
Well, that's cool. And so your friends right now, how exactly do your current friends help in, you know, boosting your communication skills? And you said your circle began to change. How did you manage that change as well? Because I know transitioning from that university environment, the coaching environment, and coming to what you do now, I guess it probably wasn't an easy transition. So how did you manage that?
Yeah, for sure. It was very difficult, actually, because the hardest decision I made in my life was quitting the job I always wanted to pursue Master Talk full time. Like, when I was in college, people talk about entrepreneurship, I would just laugh at them. I was like, I'm never going to be a business owner. Are you kidding me? Did you look at IBM starting salary? I don't care about that. I just want to be an executive. It's a guaranteed outcome. I trained my whole life to be an executive, actually. I always prided myself on calling myself the best number two in the world. Like, I never wanted to be number one, because number two makes money just fine, and it's a guaranteed set, and that was it. So that's what happened. But 2 years into Master Talk and 2 years into IBM, one, I realized that I was spending way too much time at IBM doing things I wasn't really liking. Even if I loved the company and the culture, I was in a meeting and I was just like, why am I in this meeting when I could just use that same hour and talk to Praise and be on a podcast? Like, that just makes more sense to me than just doing a technology implementation. That's one thing. And the other piece was I stopped caring as much about money. So when I was in my early 20s, I didn't have a lot of it at all. My focus was making money. That's why I got a great job. Even whether I was happy about it or not wasn't really the point. It was really, how do I accumulate wealth? But then when I started making money, I was like, oh, okay. Like, it's not that hard. It's not that crazy. Groceries aren't that expensive. So then I realized time is actually way more valuable than money. So for me, the hardest decision was to actually quit my job. Like, if you had told me at 19 that not only was I going to get the dream job, but that I was going to cut my salary by 70% and pursue my thing full time, I would have thought you were mentally ill or something. So that's the first piece that I would say. It's really difficult. The other piece of the question is around your circle. So I still keep in touch with a lot of the people in college. And by a lot, I mean probably 5%, by the way. So it's actually not that much. Just in my head, it's a lot. So probably 5%. But then the rest, and this is the dark side of success that I feel a lot of people don't talk about, is, look, if you want big results in life, you got to hang around big people, because they show you possibilities that you don't show for yourself. So most of my peer group now, the people I talk to, probably 80 to 90% Praise, are actually in their 40s. They're much older than I am. And they're my buddies. And the reason is because they have the same level of success that I do, just relative to my current age, which is 26. So there's not a lot of people in their 20s who have the success relative. Like, I don't want to make this like I'm this big gangster or something, but you know what I mean? Like, just relative. Yeah. So I have two or three of them in my age range, but not a lot. So yeah, you gotta change your circle if you want to get bigger results, for sure.
Wow, that bit is tough.
Like, you can't hang around people who only speak one language, Praise. You're never gonna get to the next level.
Yeah, well, I mean, where I am, basically, I think practically everyone speaks at least two languages. The only person, I think maybe only some, well, maybe people from the North American continent, like probably some purely native English speakers. I mean, I think probably if not for Russia, and also the fact that I learned Chinese afterwards, I would also be speaking only one language. So I guess I was just lucky to move around a little bit, and that exposed me to more. But I get what you're saying. So, because if I look around me, it's kind of normal to see someone who speaks four languages. But you go to some place and you're like, I speak these languages. And you're like, oh my gosh, wow. And for me, I think it's kind of lost the spark. So I get what you mean.
Yeah, you got to hang around some polyglots.
Yeah. And I've got a lot of them around me.
There you go.
So if someone wants to learn how to be a great public speaker, Brendan, and they come to your channel, what would you advise them to look out for? Like, okay, I'm going to go watch all the videos Brendan has on his channel. Or you would say, you know, start with these resources that I have at this particular spot.
Yeah, I would start with the video on the main channel, which is the trailer, 3 daily public speaking exercises. So if you watch that video, and I can tell you what they are, right? The random word exercise, the question drill, video messages. So you pick a random word like light bulb, create random presentations out of it, really helps with the communication. Question drill just means make a list of all the questions you think the world will ask you and just answer one of them every day, and you'll get much better at answering questions. And the third one is just send video messages to people that you love, just saying, hey, I really appreciate having you in my life. If you do those 3 things, you're all set.
Ah, the video messages part. I can barely get an audio message in. Like, I start and I delete. I start, I delete.
Hey, you have no excuse. With all the languages you're speaking, Praise, come on. Like, you should be.
I mean, I'm sending most of my messages in English. It's not like I'm going to. Well, I have some Chinese friends, but still.
You could do them in English. You don't have to do them in Mandarin.
It's a good exercise. Definitely, if I do that all the time, I'm going to build confidence in delivering, you know. I do okay with speeches, but I guess I get what you mean. It's going to improve my confidence level. But it's just, I'm going to have to do a lot of takes.
Let me help you. There's a rule in my ecosystem when I tell clients to do this. And the rule is really simple. You're not allowed to retake the video.
I see that you do not retake your videos on your channel. I think that, well, you just do like, you know, straight takes, and that's pretty cool.
Yeah, I really don't. I just go with the flow. That's how I've gotten better, like really fast, right? Not because I'm special or anything. I just practice like a dog since I was like, what, 19? So that's why my camera skills are a lot better now. But anyone can get there. I think that's really the point.
Oh, well. Okay, well.
Especially you, my goodness, Praise. You should be sending video messages easily, like easy peasy.
Oh, man. I mean, it's not like I can't do it. It's just, man, I'm always rethinking what I'm saying, you know, editing my words in my head, like, because a lot goes on in here.
Let me tell you a story around that. I think it'll help. So I did an interview once with a very nice woman named Christina, and I told her about the video message tip, and she loved it. So she did it. So she sent video messages to her grandparents who lived on the other side of the country because she never sees them. And it made their day. You know, they didn't message Christina and say, hey, Christina, I think you said an here. I think you missed this. They were just happy. Wow, I never got a video message before. They were like, wow, they were shocked. They're like, what's a video message? And they heard their granddaughter's voice and it made their day. So I think the reason why I love video messages isn't because we need to be perfect. I think it's more because it teaches us what communication is for. Because a lot of us think communication is a chore, Praise, because the education system makes us believe that. Okay, if you don't do a great presentation in your high school, you're going to lose grades. And that's the chore-like mindset that we develop. Whereas that's not why you started the podcast. You didn't do this because it's a chore. You did it because it impacts people's lives. It helps people. People learn something. And that's really the key, right, for the video messages, is even if we make mistakes, when we send them and we get replies, we realize that, oh, I don't need to be Jennifer Lopez to make an impact in the world. I don't need to be Brené Brown. I just need 20 seconds, a phone, and a video message.
All right. Well, that's a good tip. That's a good tip.
There you go.
So what other resources do you have? Okay, let's talk about where people can find you and where they can find your resources, what resources you have available and all that.
For sure, Price. It was so great to be on your show, by the way. Thanks for having me.
Yeah,
so
my
two ways to keep in touch. Absolutely. So the first one is the YouTube channel, Master Talk. Just go to that channel. You have access to hundreds of free videos on how to speak. And the second way to keep in touch is to come to one of my free communication workshops. I do a free one over Zoom that's live and interactive for free. So you can jump in on that. Super fun. And you can see a lot of me applying those tips in a live presentation. So if you want to register for our next one, go to rockstarcommunicator.com.
All right. And on Instagram as well, I think people can find you on Instagram at Master Talk.
Master Your Talk. I couldn't get that handle, unfortunately.
Master Your Talk. Yeah, works as well. All right. Do you have anything else you want to add to tell people or any other question you want to ask?
For sure, Price. I'll end with this. And it's a question for the whole community listening to this. How would your life change if you were an exceptional communicator? You know, I think the biggest challenge with this practice, with this field, with this industry, is that it's so saturated, it's laced in negativity. Oh, fear this, anxiety this, we're all going to die. I was like, no, this is not how we get better. So for me, the question has always been, are we dreaming about our communication skills? How would your life change? How would it change the lives of your family, the people around you? Imagine you could send 100 video messages, you can make everybody's day. Isn't that a fun world that we can live in? I would love for everyone to just visualize that world for yourself, because that's what gives you the motivation to actually want to do it in the first place.
Oh, wow. That's beautiful. So, guys, you heard the question. Think about it. I'm going to think about it as well. And, Brendan, I hope that we can, at some point, you know, have another great conversation like this. This was really nice. I enjoyed it. And to those listening, thank you for listening up to this point. And I hope you have a great day. See you next time. Bye-bye.